Are vegans actually unhealthy?
Does cannabis ruin your sleep?
And why are so many men taking testosterone supplements? I'm Mitch.
And I'm Greg.
And we're the creators of the popular YouTube channel ASAP Science.
Every week on our podcast Side Note by ASAP Science, we explain the science behind a controversial subject with recent research, up-to-date studies, and ridiculous stories so you are entertained while, bam, simultaneously learning.
We're here to make science make sense.
Download Side Note by ASAP Science wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to a Frequency Podcast Network production in association with City News.
This fall, while the rest of the world still struggles with COVID, the people of Uganda have been facing something far worse.
An outbreak of the Ebola virus in Uganda is continuing to spread with 109 confirmed cases and 30 deaths. According to authorities, six children in the same family have come down with Ebola in the country's capital, Kampala.
Ebola may not be as contagious as COVID, but it's much more deadly, and it certainly is transmissible, and it has made the jump across the ocean before.
Today, we are providing the information that an individual traveling from Liberia has been diagnosed with Ebola in the United States.
That clip was from 2014, and it wasn't the only case of Ebola in North America. Fortunately, at least for Canadians and Americans, the virus did not escape quarantine. The mere threat of such a disaster, though, was enough to spur immediate action to develop and distribute a vaccine for that strain of Ebola, a vaccine that Canada had a significant role in creating. That strain of Ebola is not this one, however, and that vaccine won't work. But Canada, once again, has vaccine candidates that could. They have been ready for trials, in fact, for years. And Ebola is not the only virus I could say this about. It is only now, after months of an outbreak and dozens of deaths, that trials on this particular Ebola vaccine will finally, at long last, begin. Why is that? Why create a potential vaccine for a deadly contagious virus and not get it over the finish line? Why have people been dying in Africa when the means to save them has been waiting? I'll give you three guesses. The first two don't count. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. This is The Big Story. Jason Nickerson is the humanitarian representative to Canada for Doctors Without Borders, Médecins Sans Frontières. Hello, Jason.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. Thanks for joining us. Why don't you start by outlining the state of the current Ebola outbreak that we're seeing? Where is it? How bad is it? What do we know about it?
Sure. So first of all, Ebola is what's called a viral hemorrhagic fever. So it's from a family of viruses that are called filoviruses. And they're, you know, particularly nasty kinds of viruses that have caused sporadic outbreaks, mostly in Central and West Africa over many years. So, you know, the first discovery of the virus was sometime in the 1970s. And there's been, as I say, a sporadic outbreak since then. So at the moment, there is an outbreak of Ebola that was declared in Uganda on September 20th. And since September 20th, there's been 142 confirmed cases and 56 confirmed deaths. You know, we've seen the pattern of disease shift a few times throughout this outbreak. So we saw a steep rise of cases in October when there was about 86 cases over a four-week period. And then it slowed a little bit over the most recent weeks. And actually, right now, there have been no new cases that have been linked to community transmission since sometime in mid to late November. So that's for sure a good sign.
What has been, at least until the past couple of weeks, so tricky about this particular outbreak compared to others we've seen in recent years?
So the thing to know is that there are different species of Ebola. So most outbreaks are caused by a species of the Ebola virus called Ebola Zaire. So the sort of major outbreak that happened in West Africa between 2013 and 2016 in Guinea and Sierra Leone and Liberia. So that was caused by Ebola Zaire. And you know, I don't want to say that it's common because these outbreaks remain sporadic,
right.
But it is the more common species of the Ebola virus that causes outbreaks. Now, in Uganda today, it is an outbreak of a species of the Ebola virus called Ebola Sudan. And this is much rarer. And in fact, the last outbreak was sometime in summer of 2012. So really once every 10 years, we have an outbreak of this kind of Ebola virus that we know of. Now, the challenge with that is that we actually don't have the same tools in terms of vaccines and therapeutics for Ebola Sudan as we do for Ebola Zaire. For Ebola Zaire, there are two approved vaccines and there are two therapeutics that are used. So we actually have pretty good tools in the public health toolbox for controlling and treating Ebola Zaire. But unfortunately, none of those work for Ebola Sudan.
This is admittedly a layperson's question, but even lay people have learned a lot more than they ever thought about vaccines over the past couple of years.
Absolutely.
How is it that we have a vaccine or two vaccines in this case for one strain of a disease, but not for another? My understanding is that once you've got one, it's not that hard to adjust it, or at least develop something that could work for the other.
Yeah, you know, these are what I would call a high risk, low probability kind of events. And the challenge with that is that there's essentially a market failure for these kinds of vaccines and therapeutics, right? Because these outbreaks are sporadic, and quite frankly, they occur almost exclusively in economically poorer countries. They're simply not viewed as being, there's no lucrative market that's going to attract much investment in the research and development that's needed to get these done on the part of the pharmaceutical industry. So, despite all of the good work that's been done in creating vaccine candidates for not only Ebola, but other quite nasty pathogens of real significant concern, getting these technologies, these vaccines and therapeutics, and even things like diagnostic tests to the finish line requires quite a bit of money to do the clinical trials and somebody to manufacture it and so on. And by and large, the world has decided that, it should be profit-motivated pharmaceutical companies that take on this work. And, you know, despite the public health risk that I think is quite obvious, when the market doesn't exist, the market doesn't respond. And unfortunately, that's the situation we find ourselves in, where we know there are diseases that present a real risk to global public health, some of which actually have vaccine candidates that exist, but there's very little incentive on the part of, as I say, a profit-motivated company to get these to the finish line, because the return on investment just simply isn't there.
In a few minutes, we can talk about why we have to use terms like market failure when we're talking about vaccines and public health crises. But for the moment, because we do like to position our coverage of this stuff from a Canadian perspective, can you tell us briefly about the role that Canada's National Microbiology Lab plays in finding these vaccines, if not getting them all the way to the finish line?
Yeah, so Canada has really, I would say, punched above our weight in a lot of the science behind Ebola vaccines in particular, but also other technologies for different viral hemorrhagic fevers. So it goes back to really the early 2000s when the Public Health Agency of Canada's National Microbiology Lab, which is in Winnipeg, is really a world-class laboratory for dealing with high risk and special pathogens, They started working on a vaccine. They had good scientific expertise that was in-house. There was a recognized risk at that time that a virus like Ebola could spread quickly from a small, you know, small community outbreaks to a global public health epidemic or pandemic. But also Ebola was recognized as a bioterrorism threat at that point. So there was a lot of sort of stars that aligned. And so they set to work and discovered an Ebola vaccine using something called a recombinant vesicular stomatitis virus, which is just the fancy name for the platform that they used. And, you know, did the necessary testing on the vaccine to show that it worked, at least in animals, and offered very good protection. Now, as I say, at the time, there hadn't been a large outbreak of Ebola. And so the market for these technologies was quite small. So in 2010, Canada licensed the vaccine technology to a small biotech company in the United States. It was called Bioprotection Systems. And they were actually working on cancer vaccines. So they, you know, as far as we know, acquired the vaccine just for the intellectual property, essentially. But there was no subsequent work that was done on it until the major outbreak in West Africa in 2013, 2014. And at that moment, it was licensed under quite a bit of public pressure from that American company to Merck, a large pharmaceutical company, mm-hmm. and they're the ones who continue to own it today. But the clinical trials that were done in that outbreak received huge amounts of public funding from the Canadian government, from the American government, and many others. So it ultimately is a vaccine that today is owned by Merck, but was developed through global collaborative efforts and collaborative funding, including from Canada.
In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together. We were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a 6-part podcast from CBC. Available now.
I understand from your writing and from Doctors Without Borders that we've also, at this microbiology lab, developed a potential, at least, vaccine candidate for Ebola Sudan, which is mm-hmm. what we need to be worried about right now.
Yeah, that's right. So there are actually a number of vaccine candidates for really concerning viruses that were developed in the early 2000s for Ebola Sudan, Ebola Zaire, Marburg, and Lassa fever. And unfortunately, there's actually been outbreaks of all three of these viruses this year alone. There is an ongoing Lassa fever outbreak in Nigeria. There was a Marburg outbreak in Ghana in July of this year, and now we have Ebola Sudan in Uganda. So Canada actually discovered potentially viable vaccine candidates for all of these diseases that have by and large been sitting on a shelf.
Wow.
As I say, simply because there isn't a clear pathway for getting them to the finish line. So there's a lot of good work that's been done sort of ahead of time, but you know, it's not just Canada, but really the world doesn't have a good strategy for moving these things forward and making sure we've got doses in places where we need them so that we can do the clinical trials to assess if they're effective or not and hopefully, you know, create stockpiles to be able to deploy them when they're needed.
Why not? I realize that's a big question, and I don't intend it as a rhetorical one because you've already kind of mentioned that, you know, private companies are typically needed to come in and do this work. Why can't Canada or other countries or, you know, the World Health Organization, which presumably has some stake in this, help get these vaccines to the finish line without needing private companies to be able to make a profit?
Yeah, I mean, I think especially coming out of COVID, that's the conversation that we need to be having, right? I mean, we're an organization that has long been pushing for equitable and affordable access to all medical technologies. And we've seen time and time again what happens when medicines and vaccines are priced out of reach of of our patients and the health systems that we work in. And so, you know, there's a fundamental problem here with medicine's availability and affordability. But in this case, there is truly a market failure for a lot of emerging infectious diseases research and development. And I think relying on kind of prevailing market forces to pick some of these technologies up and finish them quickly and make them globally accessible it's just simply not going to work. So coming out of COVID, you know, there is, and I shouldn't say coming out of COVID, but, yeah. You know, after living through COVID for the last 2.5 or 3 years, you know, I think that there is starting to be a recognition that we need to find some way of developing enough doses and pre-positioning doses of viable vaccine candidates for some of these high-risk, low-probability diseases, and making sure that, you know, we've got things like clinical trial protocols that are already developed so that we can, you know, we know how we're going to do the science to assess if these vaccines work or not, but also just manufacturing some of these doses ahead of time. Now, that's going to require somebody to pay for this stuff.
Right.
If it's not going to be pharmaceutical companies, it's going to have to be governments and other entities. I mean, there are certainly some charities that have an interest in this as well. But I think by and large, it's likely going to be governments that are going to have to put money up front to establish some of these vaccine candidate stockpiles and consider, you know, where we're going to keep them, how we're going to maintain them, and what we're going to do with them so that we can roll them out quickly and ethically during disease outbreaks in the hope of, you know, generating enough evidence that we can, as I say, get them to the finish line when we need them. Because simply waiting for outbreaks to happen and then scrambling to try and find vaccine doses or starting afresh puts us well behind the eight ball.
So where are we on that right now? And that's my last question, I guess. It's too much probably to ask for Canada to do this on its own. But given that we've played such a key role in developing some of these vaccines, what are you hearing from our government? What have other governments or health organizations around the world said about this? And are they coming to your consensus? And is anything moving on that front?
Yeah, you know, I think there's a few things that are happening. So first of all, there's a recognition that we are very likely to see more emerging infectious disease outbreaks happening over the coming decades. So there was a modeling paper that came out sometime in the spring or the summer that assessed that over the next 50 years, there could be somewhere in the vicinity of 15,000 cross-species transmission events, meaning, you know, a virus moves from one species to another simply because of climate change, right? I mean, there's just going to be more interaction between humans and wildlife and so on over the coming years. And I think governments and medical organizations are well aware of the fact that, you know, we're seeing shifting patterns of disease. We're seeing, you know, diseases emerge in places where they just traditionally haven't as a result of climate change and you know, global mobility. So I think the risk to an extent is recognized. Now, what to do about this, I think, remains one of the fundamental questions, because it does require global collaboration.
Good thing we're great at that.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I mean, I don't think we need every country in the world working on their own Ebola vaccine. We need a few good candidates, but we need to also invest in vaccine manufacturing to make sure that we have doses on hand.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're not talking about huge numbers of doses either. In the global stockpile of the Ebola Zaire vaccine, it's 500,000 doses, which is a lot, but, you know, these things are never going to be blockbusters. So I think there's probably a role for investing in local production, which of course is a major topic of conversation coming out of COVID, including here in Canada, where we have a public vaccine manufacturing facility that has yet to produce a single dose of anything. But really what we need from governments is to come up with a plan. Right, we need to continue to invest in research and development of medical technologies like vaccines and therapeutics for things that have really significant public health impacts, both in Canada and abroad. But ultimately, you know, I think somebody's got to take the wheel, so to speak, and sort of drive us down a path that has a clear direction, so that we're not just discovering things and letting them linger on the shelf in the hope that somebody comes and picks them up, but actually, you know, discovering and recognizing useful technologies and pushing them through the clinical trials to generate the evidence that we need to hopefully have them available when we need them.
Speaking of clinical trials, I love when we get the opportunity to end a show that can be mostly depressing on a slightly positive note. So tell me about these clinical trials that are finally due to actually begin in Uganda.
Yeah, so there is actually going to be a clinical trial that's going to start hopefully sometime in the next couple of days. And so there's actually a number of vaccine candidates that exist for this specific Ebola Sudan species. So in the clinical trial, it's going to be led by Ugandan researchers. There's going to be three vaccines that are trialed. One's from an organization called the Sabin Vaccine Institute. One's from the University of Oxford. And one is from a not-for-profit called IAVI. And they're the ones who actually have the license for this Canadian-discovered vaccine technology. And they're also working on vaccines for some other viral hemorrhagic fevers. So the first doses actually arrived in country on Thursday, and there were 1,200 doses of the Sabin vaccine that arrived, and then the other vaccine candidates should come in the coming days. So, you know, hopefully the silver lining in all of this is that, you know, there are some vaccine candidates that hopefully, you know, we'll get to go through a clinical trial and generate some evidence, and hopefully that leads to, you know, some vaccines that are available for use in future outbreaks. But you know, there's sort of an interesting twist in all of this, which is that the Canadian discovered vaccine, we didn't actually know that there were doses that existed of it until sometime in October, because it, you know, it went through this really long, circuitous path from the Canadian government's National Microbiology Lab, where it was discovered in the early 2000s. It was licensed to this American company in 2010, and then Merck acquired it in 2014, gave it back to the Canadian government, who then licensed it to IAVI. You know, it was this really long path, and it wasn't until October that Merck actually discovered that they had made 100,000 doses of it sometime in 2015 or 2016, and basically didn't tell anybody, and you know, found them in a freezer somewhere and are making them available for this clinical trial. So, you know, look, this is a good thing. There's vaccine doses that are being mobilized, but I think it really gets to the heart of the fact that, you know, we just need a better, more predictable way of doing vaccine and drug development for these kinds of emerging infectious diseases, so that we're better prepared and don't have to rely on a pharmaceutical company, you know, finding 100,000 doses somewhere behind the ice cream in the freezer.
Well, fingers crossed at least for this vaccine and for a better process in the future. Thank you so much for this, Jason.
Thanks so much for having me.
Jason Nickerson, humanitarian representative to Canada for Doctors Without Borders, Médecins Sans Frontières. That was the big story. Earlier this week, we discussed genetic genealogy and the role you or anyone else in your family could play in bringing to light a crime committed by a family member in the past. We did initially say that this would be awkward, which sparked this truly excellent response from a listener. Play the voicemail, Joe.
Just listen to the episode on the genetic crime tracing. You and your guest made it seem as if that would be really awkward or somehow bad for someone to discover that they had uploaded information that led to one of their relatives being convicted of a heinous crime. Shocking, perhaps, but it would be, wouldn't that be the greatest thing ever? Wouldn't that be if some uncle, great uncle of yours, had committed a rape and murder, and you were in the chain that got them arrested and finally brought to account for that? That'd be the best thing ever, would it not?
Now that was The Big Story. You can find us at thebigstorypodcast.ca. You can also find us on Twitter at TheBigStoryFPN. You can email us, hello@thebigstorypodcast.ca, or you can call, like that fellow did. Leave us a message. If it's that good, we might play it. 416-935-5935.
You can find The Big Story in every podcast player. If you're in Apple, you can check out our subscription. But don't worry, the entire podcast still remains free. You can listen to any episode you like without paying. You can also get us on the smart speaker. Just ask it to play The Big Story podcast, and you will get the latest episode. Thanks for listening. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. We'll talk tomorrow.
In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together. We were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a 6-part podcast from CBC. Available now.